from Dallas, Texas.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm sold on San Francisco. You say that. I had two charming ladies take me on a tour today. And they certainly did a fine job. I saw everything I wanted to see in a short time. I'd lunch at the Cliff House and saw the Embarcadero and Fisherman Dwarf from the top of the mark. We covered a lot of ground. And it's nice to be here. I've been asked to go over the early ground, the Ray A. And to do so, I've got to give you some of my background as a young man. I was born and raised in Albany, New York. Some of you know, the capital of the state. And my father and mother rented a summer cottage in Manchester, Vermont, which is only 60 miles away. And it was a short trip up there by train and later on by automobile. Although I remember the first time that we made it, the car that we half-built and ourselves in our foundry machine shop, it took 3 days. And then they wound up on a hill 4 miles south of the village that broke down for the third or fourth time. They had to be hauled in by a team of horses, and I can see the local constable saying, "Get a horse, get a horse." I can still hear it. I see my father and my older brothers coming in. And it was there that I met Bill Wilson in Manchester, Vermont. I went to school in Albany, but I formed a great friendship with the minister's son, and he went to the local school up there, it's a high school. And he persuaded me, and I in turn sold a bill of goods to my family, to stay up there a winter and go to a school up there. And I had met Bill casually before, but I got to know him very well that winter, and we became good friends. And that's where our friendship started. And of course, he married Lois Willer Burnham, who had a summer cottage directly across from ours on the main street of the town. And I knew her from childhood. In fact, she's a little older than I am. She can remember me when I was in the baby carriage. And so that takes us up to the time that I knew Bill Wilson. And my last year in school, which turned out to be my last year because I got drinking and was expelled. Well, I wasn't exactly expelled, but the principal of the school wrote my father a letter that summer that I didn't think they could do anything more for me, which is practically the same. So I just didn't show up that fall, and my father put me to work in his iron foundry. And my drinking was then somewhat regulated. I would hold it down on Saturday nights, although I'd get drunk. I was never could tell what I was going to do. I might drink some of the older men under the table, and I might get drunker than a hoot. I'd have 3 or 4 drinks and raise the devil and have a hard time. But I generally managed to keep it on Saturday night. I knew as a young man, I think, that winter that Bill and I went to school, we talked the situation over because the condition was in both our families. My father drank too much, my brothers did, and I could only figure that I was just the same as they were in makeup, temperamental makeup, and I felt it go the same way. But one time in Albany, I walked into the barroom of the Hotel Tonight and I ordered a glass of beer. And it was the finest glass of beer I ever tasted. And I said, "This is for me. Just that one beer. Just a little warm feeling it gave you." And I used it because I had no confidence as a young man. In the gathering of people, I was all right with one or two of my cronies. But when I got on the gathering, I was lost. And I found that alcohol would overcome that, and I'd become more or less the life of the party. And I guess that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be kingpin in everything I did, probably. And yet I wasn't quite good enough. And that alcohol brought me up to the point where at least I thought I was. But it began to get pretty bad as the years went on, and the Saturday night's drunk progressed into one or two nights during the week. And when the Christmas holidays came around, and the gigs came out, and the dances, and all that, like, I didn't get much work done in the foundry. I got to drinking pretty heavy. And it went from bad to worse. And I was in lots of hot water and lots of trouble. Got so that I'd go on and drunk and couldn't get off it. I remember taking the first drink in the morning and that started the ball rolling right back in the model again. Well, to skip a lot of the blow-by-blow description and get up to 1934, I was living alone in a house in Manchester. My father and mother are both dead. And strange as it may seem, we never bought a house up there until 1923. My mother died in 27, my father in 29. I was living there alone, and I was drinking to beat the devil. My brothers were all married, and they'd taken most of the furniture, and they left some stuff for me, and I lived there. And I was trying to paint the house. Well, I had a ladder. I didn't have sufficient equipment, but I was too shaky to get up on that ladder. And I was making a mess of things, generally. I'd been arrested a couple of times for drunkenness out around the town. And three times in Vermont, there's a mandatory 6 month sentence in the state prison. So, these fellows came along, a couple of them that I'd been drinking with. Used to drink with, known them for years, and they collared me down at the house one day, and they started talking to me about this Oxford group they'd become interested in. And I listened because they made sense. I know that I don't think that they were alcoholics in the sense that I am. They both drank heavily. But I think that they were more or less power hungry, though, both of them. One was a New York stockbroker, and he just wanted to have a world by the horns where he could run it. But that talked a lot of sense to me. They left a book with me, and they said, "Now, you've been trying to run your life your own way. Down on your luck, and you're not getting anywhere, and you're drinking yourself to death. Why don't you try turning your life over to God?" So that made sense to me, and I sobered up for a few days, and I wrote my brother an old man that I'd like to get some help in the house, and he wrote back and said, "Go ahead, get a local painter, and see what kind of a deal you can make with him." Well, this man had sent over a lot of equipment and one of his painters, and the two of us got the thing done. We took over 2 weeks to do it because it was a big house, a lot of work to be done around cutting sash on the windows and everything. Well, as soon as that house was painted, I lost all interest again. There was nothing to look forward to, no goal to strive for. At least that house painting was something to be done, to get accomplished. So I went right back into bottling. And I was apprehended by the local law for a time. And I appeared before the judge down in Bennington, the local constable whom I went to school with that 1 year. He took me down there, and I appeared before him. And it so happened that he was the father of one of the boys that had come to see me, Seber Graves, and this was Judge Graves, his father. And this is Friday, so he'll be back here Monday. He said, "I want you back here sober." And I'm just mentioning this, it's a very little incident, but in my life it was a big one. It really meant something. When the lad that I went down drove me back to the house, and I went in there all alone, I remember that I had three nice cold bottles of ale down cellar. And I said, "Well, if I drink that ale and space it along, it'll just sort of keep me up a little bit, and I won't hit the depths. And I can't possibly get drunk because I can't tell anymore in town. Everybody knows about this, and I've shut off my supply." And I walked down, sir, and I picked up one of those bottles, and I said, "No, wait a minute." And Jeff said, "Don't come back here sober, but this isn't exactly cricket. Don't take a drink," is what he meant, really. "And you could get back there sober. He'd never know anything about it, but it isn't exactly honest." So I walked upstairs again, and I got up there, and I said, "Oh, the devil, this little devil sat in my shoulder. Go on down and take that ale." I walked up and down the stairs three or four times. And finally, I picked them up and put them in a carton and took them over to the man next door. And I said, "Here's a present for you." And believe me, that was the weight that was lifted off my shoulder. It really was. I felt a release from that time on. And I know that night, I sat down beside my bed and said my prayers like I hadn't said them in years. And I said to God, I said, "I really mean business. I want to quit this drinking." Well, I stayed around the house for a couple of weeks. It was in October and beginning to get cold, nor inadequate. I didn't want to start the furnace. It was a hot water thing. And one of these men that had come to see me, I didn't know, there was a third man had come along into the picture. And he also had become interested in the Oxford group. And he said, "Well, why don't you shut up the house and come down and stay with me for a few days?" He lived in the town below, about 15 miles below, south of Manchester, and he had a home there. And he said, "Why don't you come and live with me? And we got a lot of speaking to do." And less than 2 weeks after I joined this thing, I got interested in it. I was out talking my head off. places in Vermont. One weekend, I spoke 5 times. 2 churches, a junior college, and 2 town meetings. Now, I don't know what I spoke about or anything, but I guess that the people could sense the fact that I had found something. So that went on for a while, and we had people up from New York, sort of what they called house parties, the Oxford group called them. And then I went down to New York, and I stayed with one of these lads who'd come to see me for a week or 2 weeks. And then he made an arrangement with Calvary Episcopal Church, who ran a mission on 23rd Street and First Avenue in New York City in what they call the Gas House District. It used to be called that. And for me to go down, I had a brotherhood of 12 men who ran the place, supposedly under Oxford Group lines and principles. So I went down there and lived for a year. I sometimes thought, think that I shouldn't have done that, maybe a year there, but they wanted me to do it. The only reason is I think I got lazy. I didn't want to get out and work too hard. I mean, that isn't making money, and I had just enough to get by. I had a place to sleep that didn't cost me anything. But on the other hand, maybe it was meant. And in passing, I don't know whether many of you know much about the Oxford Group. I'm not too familiar with it. The Reverend Mr. Glass told me that he'd been a member of it. I'm not too sure of its origins, except it was started by a man named Frank Bookman, who was a member of the cloth. Somewhere in the early 30s, it was 1934 when I came into the picture. And I think that the great interest in it at that time, perhaps, was due to the Wall Street crash of 1929. People who had lost everything, their shirt and everything else in that crash, realized that they had been paying devotion to false gods. That they were not, they were not on the right track, and they were completely lost, and they were searching for something, and they heard of this and came there. And of course, among that number were a great many alcoholics, like myself. And I was there, and I really went into the thing with the spirit and tried my best to learn everything they had to teach, and they were pretty thorough in their indoctrination. They had some very fine men, but very wise men, too. And I tried my level best to get something out of that. And I think the reason that they failed, although I understand that they're still in existence out here on the West Coast under the name of Moral Rearmament, they changed the name. And that name in itself was a misnomer, because the thing started here in this country and people went over to Oxford University in England, and in turn from there they sent what they called a team to South Africa, and some reporters there got a hold of it and referred to them as the group from Oxford. And that name stuck and could have called the Oxford Group, and it was no more the Oxford Group than Man in the Moon. But I tried, and it was during this time that I was living here, and I'd gotten in the mission, and I heard about Bill Wilson, and I heard that he'd been drinking heavily, and was not wanted in very many offices in Wall Street where he worked. He'd made such a mess of himself. So I determined that maybe I could help him, and I really put some thought into it because I knew that Bill would either take it lock, stock, and barrel and go for it, and he'd really put his weight behind and get in and push, or he'd reject it. And I think the reason he accepted it was because he saw me sober after so many years of drunkenness, and he was in great need at the time. It just so happened that I was the man who came along at the right time when Bill needed it, with what happened to be the right medicine. So Bill came and went to the Oxford Group meetings with me. And we did a lot of work together. Bill, when I first saw him that night, didn't sober up right away. 3 or 4 days later, he came to one of our meetings at the mission. We had meetings there every night. We had new men, and we did the ones beds if we could, and we had the available beds. And Bill came there with a sailor, and he was drunk, and he even insisted on getting up in the rostrum and making a speech. And the superintendent said, "Get him down." And I said, "Let him go, see what he's got." Well, he was all twisted up as a drunk is, but he had gotten something out of my talk. As he walked to the subway with me that night, and he said, "I don't know what you got." And he said, "Whatever it is, I want it." So, next thing I heard was he'd gone to Town's Hospital. He got himself 3 or 4 bottles of beer in a taxi, and he drank the beer on the way up in the taxi. And I went up to see him, and I visited him there 2 or 3 times. And when he got out, I sort of rode herd on him. And got him to come around to meetings, and pretty soon he took a hold of the thing. And he in turn went out, and as you know, the following summer met Dr. Bob in Akron and formed that great friendship and that great fellowship that was so necessary to the founding of AA, along with the sister out there. I can't think of her name for a minute. And it was so necessary to the founding of AA. First Akron claims that they were the first AA group. I don't quite see how, because from the Akron group meetings, Bill Wilson continued the meetings on at his house in Brooklyn. And then we went to Steinway Hall, and so New York had a group that was in perfect succession all the time. But when it became Alcoholics Anonymous and when it from springing off from the Action Group, I can't tell you, and I don't think Bill can or anybody. Nobody kept a diary and nobody knew what it was all about. And you go back 27 years, it's pretty hard to remember all the details or to get things straight. The book came out about 1939. And of course, that was a great incentive. And so was the on the Saturday Evening Post, Jack Alexander. Well, in the summer of 1936, after I'd been in New York nearly 2 years, I decided to go back to Albany. And I lived in the Mission, and I'd moved from the Mission to Ann Ellison's house, and I wasn't doing much more in the line of endeavor for pay than I had in the other place, and I decided I'd better go back to Albany, my hometown, where I'd made such a mess of things, and where I had so many amends to make. And I did. I went back in the summer, in July or August. I finally got a job at Ford Motor Company up in Green Island, which is 8 or 9 miles north of Albany. I worked 2 weeks on the day shift and 2 weeks on the night. And I used to come down when I was working on the night shift. I got through Thursday morning. Wasn't too back in again until Sunday. I'd come down to New York every third or fourth weekend. And I don't know, I was getting away from the tracks. So I was getting away from what I had found, and I guess there was some one thing that I wanted that God hadn't given me, and I figured that something was wrong, and this little boy had been mistreated. So I got off. I know one of the men that worked with me in Ford said the last week before you went to New York on that last trip, he said, you were just like a piece of steel wire. He said, you were so tense. He said, I knew something was going to happen. He wasn't an alcoholic himself. Well, I used to see a girl down there. There was no romance in her. She was just a friend, and take her out to dinner. And I took her out to dinner this one night, and she always had a scotch highball, possibly two, and that's all. She wasn't innocent anymore. That was enough. Just sociability. Little pickup. Well, this night I ordered one. She said, what are you going to do now? She said, kick your legs out from under you. You got 3 or 4 months, nearly a year of sobriety, or 2 years of sobriety, and you're going to kick it all and throw it away? I said, oh, one wing won't hurt me. Oh, no. That night at 12 o'clock, she finally got the taxi, let me off the Lexington Hotel in New York and get rid of me because I was roaring drunk about that time. And I called Bill up, by the way, and he sent a couple of guys over the next morning, and he got me out of the hotel over to his house. But it didn't do any good. You start a cycle like that, you got to finish it. And Bill went away for that weekend, and there I was in the house, and he told me there was a bottle of scotch in there. My suffering's so bad, I needed a drink, so I stayed drunk for a week there. And I finally went back to Albany and back to the Ford Motor Company. I showed up there Monday morning, and the superintendent met me at the clock and said, where you been? I said, I was down in New York and I was taking sick with ptomaine poison. Yeah. That's my story. I'm going to stick to it. At least I'm going back to work. And I had a man back there, a straw boss, who didn't like me for sour apples, and I guess the feeling was mutual. And I went to work on this machine. I was an inspector in the springs division. And I picked up a leaf of a spring to put it on this testing machine. He said, what are you doing back here? He said, we got a crane broken down out there in the yard, and we got to unload steel by hand. Now, he said, get out there. And out I went in the yard, and I unloaded with this other guy. And I swear, at the end of that day, my hands, I couldn't open them. They were just cramped from that flat steel. Bale after bale of it, you know, bundle after bundle of it. And I used to drive back here back and forth from Albany with a man. And we shared expenses, and we got in the car after the gate, and he says, I tried to raise some money for you. He says, I know damn well you need a drink. I said, never mind raising the money I got it. Let's get to the nurse's saloon. Well, that's the last I ever saw of the Ford plant. That was it. A few days later, the man appeared from the Ford plant, one of the security men, and he had a check for one day's pay, and And ask for my badge, and they... So, from then on, I was right back in the same old situation again. Drinking, getting sober for a few months, getting drunk again, no incentive to live. I knew I was doing wrong. I knew that I knew the answers, but I couldn't apply them. And this went on in a very unsatisfactory situation. I spent a couple of summers in Kent, Connecticut, in High Watch Farm, which is the first alcoholic farm, or health farm, in this country. I helped run that. I was assistant manager. And then when the man who ran that went on to Beech Hill in New Hampshire, in Dublin, New Hampshire, I went on there with him. I was there in 46 and 47, I was in Connecticut. And 49, I was in Beech Hill in New Hampshire, and I helped him run that. And I was sober. As long as I had responsibility and something to do, and when that ended, I went right back to the bottle. And I kicked around New York and kicked around New York. I spent some time in a place called the Chester Crest. And that's, they call it the New York home for intemperate men. It's now gone out of existence. It's too bad because it's quite a place. And they worked so pretty hard out on the farm and doing work around the place. And they gave you 5 meetings a night. You had to attend 5 meetings a night and twice on Sunday. And believe me, I got my fill of meetings. But it was right the same thing back again. So that brings us up to the summer of 1953. And I was there in New York. I'd come from this place up there. I'd gotten drunk and gotten kicked out of there. And I was wandering around New York. I used to drop in the intergroup, and it was then on 28th Street in Lexington Avenue. And I must admit it, I was looking for a handout. Trying to get enough to get a few drinks. So I got in a place and I could get a few drinks, I could cash a few more. Hazel Rice, bless her, came over to me and she said, I think I got something for you. She said, Charlie Milton has been over in Paris, France, and he ran into one of your friends from the Oxford group who came to see you originally. And then, in passing here, I must say that these men deserve as much credit as I do for taking a message to Bill because they brought the message to me. And she said, he wants to see us. So she got right on the telephone and called Charlie, and Charlie says, hold him there till 5 o'clock and I'll be down. Well, I waited. 5 o'clock, Charlie came down. He said, where do you drink? And I said, over on 3rd Avenue, right over there on 28th Street. And he says, come on, let's go over. And we sat down and walked to the bar and got a couple of drinks and sat down. I got a drink. He got a Coke. And he says, well, how would you like to go to Texas? Texas. My God, who wants to go to Texas? So they got no water down there. The cattle are dying all over the place. I don't want to go to Texas. I'm broke. I haven't any strength to my name, and I have no clothes. Well, he said, I think it'd be a good idea to get you out of New York, and I think I can arrange to have you taken in down there. Maybe some of those guys will take you in on a ranch and get you full of help again. Well, he bought me another drink, and then he said, here's $5 an hour. He says, you think this thing over? He said, I realize it's quite a proposition to take and swallow in one night. So I went home, and I drank up to my limit of, say, the dollar. I think in those days that I learned to drink somewhat because of necessity. I had gotten so sick of being out in the cold weather in New York all night long and riding a subway and getting tense and spending 10 days in Rikers Island, which is not pleasant. And it's not pleasant to walk around the streets in the slush all night long. I used to walk from 14th Street up to 76th Street and back and over 42nd Street to 5th Avenue, down 5th Avenue, 14th and over again and back up. And it takes 3 or 4 trips like that to make a night. Until something opens, and if it's 4 o'clock in the morning, or if you haven't got a sentry, you can get it. And I guess I learned how to hang out at 75 cents and maybe a quarter over to get a start in the morning. 75 cents to get a bed. So he repeated the performance. He came down at 5 o'clock and took me over there and bought me another couple of drinks and then gave me the $5 again on Thursday night. And he said, if you want to pick this thing up, you can over see me. He said, here's where I live. Here's my telephone number. Well, I had saved enough from the night before that I could go through Friday night. And I went through Friday night all right, and Saturday morning I said, this is it. And I walked up there to see him. I went into his apartment house, and he was out in the street, and I just happened to catch sight of him. He came in. Well, he said, you're ready to go to Texas. I said, I don't know about Texas, but I've quit drinking as of now. As of last night. Well, he said, let's go up in that room, and we'll have a cup of coffee and talk it over. So he told me the Texas idea, and he took me out and got me a clean shirt and gave me a hot shower and threw away my underclothes and got some fresh stuff. And he called Dallas and got a hold of Ole Lancaster and Cersei Whaley. And they made arrangements. They said, yes, I can hear Cersei. Or I think it was Ole. His booming voice from the other end. All right, send the Yankee son of a bitch down here. Sunday, we got flight reservations for Sunday night, and they put me on that plane, and I swear that plane never left striking LaGuardia Fields. Well, Ryan, seems to me I was in a complete fog, and Charlie had to find a whiskey there and wouldn't give it to me. And I told him a couple of years later, I'm going back and start the whole thing all over again, and I want that plane to come down here. Well, they put me up. Cersei Whaley was running me in Texas Clinic at that time, and they put me up there. But they didn't give me a drink. They did give me some goofballs, and those things just make me nuttier than the seven fruitcakes. And the next morning, there were a bunch of people in and out of my room. You'd think I was Exhibit A. They wanted to come in and see this damn Yankee curiosity, and couldn't sober himself up, but had been able to sober Bill Olson up. And there I was going through this thing, and there's anything I know want is people around me when I'm going to hang over and coming off on. I just want to crawl up in a corner. There were more people in and out of that room. You think of some Hollywood celebrity being in there. So I just burrowed further into the bedclothes and just hid myself, and it was hot in there, and I turned off the air conditioner, and Cersei would come in and say, what do you turn that thing off for? I said, because it's playing music. And it was. And all the symphonies and bands and everything else marching. I went out of the street one day trying to find the band, and they couldn't find it. And I used to stand and look out of a little portal in the front door, like one of these isolation doors, and there was an apartment house with a balcony across the way, and I'd see a chair over here, and I'd get up and float over and get down over here. I thought that I was never coming back. I mean that sincerely, as I stand, and I thought my mind had never come back. And there was an old colored lady in there. She says, you leave Mr. Eddie alone and let him come out of this in his own way. I said, he'd get well. And they were just about ready to send me to a state hospital and commit. And I was gone. I went out walking one night, and I don't know where I walked. And I walked at 4 o'clock in the morning, and the police picked me up. And they put me in one cell after another. And I don't know, later on it developed that they thought I was the leader of a car theft gang because I was leaning up against the car. I'd gotten so tired I couldn't walk any further. Well, as soon as this occurred, and there was another one of my great friends down there, heard of it, came down and got me out. And then I began to shake that off and get back in condition. And began to, as I said, I began to be some fun around there, and I began to go to the AA club. I know I walked by it a dozen times. I'd walk by the dining thing and was scared and walk the steps. Shaken and ashamed. Finally, I did, and I went around and got in the spirit of the thing, and I began to get some of this Texas spirit, which, as you know, is very great. And I began to think that maybe I could get the world with a tail again. And I sold some stock in an insurance company, which has turned out to be a fizzle. And I got into an oil deal, which also turned out to be a fizzle. With the consequence that after 13 months, I got discouraged. And I said, well, I guess I never was meant to come down here to Texas. I should have died there in New York. Because I don't think I would have survived another winter. And I got drunk again. Well, I didn't stay drunk very long because the law got a hold of me and arrested me. But I got bailed out by the guy that was in there drunk himself that I knew in Dallas. And I was bailed out, but I was back in the county that night for 9 days after the half a day in the city jail. And when I got out of the county at the end of 9 days, one day for good behavior, I was promptly picked up and put back in the city jail. So my drinking was stretched out over about 3 weeks, but there was only about 4 or 5 days of active participation with the bottle. But then I had that long period of going right back into that mental depression again and thinking that there was no use. Scared to go out on the street, scared to meet them. Every time I see anybody with a uniform on, I turn right around and run. Instead of that, but I got out of that. I began to pick up, and then I think finally I began to realize that things were not going to, that the oil wells were not going to come out. And I had to accept that I had kicked myself around, whether it was wholly my fault or not, didn't make any difference. The result was there, and I kicked myself around so long, and it was going to be extremely hard to get a job, and that I would have to settle for what I could do. And I went to work for one of the boys there who owned a printing plant, and I worked for him a year. For the magnificent sum of $37 a week, I think. And I didn't have a car in those days, and then I was out of work for a while, and I worked for Vicky Sheridan out on the road, he's a construction man. I was his flagman on two or three jobs over in Irving around there. And then I worked with Ben Thompson in a brickyard, and that is, he was reclaiming old brick and selling them for antique brick. And then my present boss came along and gave me this job, and I've been there ever since. And I've been thankful that I could again assume responsibility, and I have been helping out another person in Dallas. And that has given me some incentive to stay sober, so that I've been able to get together 6 years. And that alone has helped me. I am trying to forget the big shot stuff, although sometimes when the pressure of money is on, it is hard to go along and not complain about the pricks of life. But nevertheless, I say to myself, if I had lived and hadn't been sent to Texas, I would have died there in New York. And so I am grateful to Charlie Milton and Seba Graves in Paris, and Charlie, who put the thing into motion and followed it through, and it cost him money, and it cost him time and effort to send me down to Texas. And I'm grateful to the people in Texas who were patient with me until I snapped out of it and came out of the fog. And then the gang in New York had discussed it with me, but there were a few like Hazel Rice stuck by me and figured that I had it in me if they could only get me in the right spot. So I must put aside the things that I think I'd like and things that I want and yet are not good for me, probably, and be grateful that I am alive and able to assume the responsibilities of a man and hold a job down. And I am also grateful that I'm able to come out and make these talks. And I'm grateful to you people for asking me here, for those who put up the money to bring me here, and for my two companions today who took me on such a very good trip. And I must say that the hospitality of California is right on a par with that of Texas. And I want to thank you all.
The means of getting well. There are more people sober as a result of attending AA and doing nothing else than there are as a result of people who participate in all other forms of counseling and therapy combined. AA is by far the most readily available and the most powerful recovery resource. But AA has its limitations. It never was intended to be all things to all people. Alcoholics Anonymous is still in the business of helping alcoholics to stop drinking. The issue that we have, the reason there are so many spin-off 12-step programs is because the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has by policy stuck very closely to its major goal, its major mission, which is to help alcoholics. They, of course, allow other organizations such as Narcotics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Marijuana Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, and right on down to use their steps and principles, but these other organizations are developing as separate organizations, separate and apart from AA, so that AA can keep its focus on its primary purpose of helping alcoholics. Now, there are many alcoholics who require more extensive help than AA alone can give. One of the biggest problems inherent in the 12-step fellowship back in its inception in 1935 was the inability to get medical treatment for alcoholics who are undergoing medical withdrawal. Out of that need, of course, arose what is now called the Minnesota model of treatment, where alcoholics were offered detoxification and extended rehabilitation services. From its very inception, AA members have recognized what they call the need to go to any length. And any length often involves treatment by knowledgeable physicians, psychologists, psychiatrists, alcoholism counselors, marriage and family counselors, legal counselors, financial counselors, and so on down the road. AA has no position for or against counseling from these other sources. Individual AA members have benefited from counseling and therapy throughout the ages. As a matter of fact, one of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson, participated in psychiatric treatment for depression after he found his sobriety. Now, there are problems, people with problems that require help over and above what Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. Now, some of the examples of these problems that require special treatment are these. The first we already mentioned, acute withdrawal from alcohol and other drugs. AA does not replace the need for medical detox. Medical detoxification services. If you have someone going into severe acute withdrawal from alcohol or drugs, take them to a hospital first. And if that hospital specializes in the treatment of chemical dependency, they will be sure to get those people to AA after they are detoxed and the life-threatening crisis of withdrawal is over. The second is medical complications, coexisting physical illnesses that coexist with alcohol and in the alcoholic and early recovery. AA is not a substitute for medical treatment. It's never intended to be. One of the strongest supporters I've ever met of Alcoholics Anonymous is a person named Father Joseph Martin. Do any of you know Father Martin? Know of him? Say, I had the privilege of spending extensive time working with Father Martin at his treatment center outside of Baltimore named Father Martin's Ashley. And I've had extensive opportunity to talk with him about the steps, and I've heard him lecture quite frequently. And I'm impressed with his common sense approach to the program. One time he stood up and he said very clearly, "Ladies and gentlemen, if I walk out of the lecture hall tonight and I get hit by a truck, take me to the hospital, don't take me to an AA meeting." And I think we need to bring to bear some very practical common sense in our approach to AA. If someone is in withdrawal or if they're physically ill, the first stop has to be a place that can provide appropriate medical treatment with an addiction focus. Now, the third category of persons who have difficulty with AA, who needs extensive help, is people suffering from a condition called post-acute withdrawal, PAW. Post-acute withdrawal is the long-term after-effects of chronic alcohol and drug poisoning on the brain. Long-term after-effects of the result of chronic alcohol and drug poisoning on the brain. We used to believe 10 or 15 years ago that when a person stopped drinking, within 5 to 10 days, the brain returned to normal. We now know that that's not true. Some of the brain damage that results the brain dysfunction is lifelong. The bulk of the symptoms, the major symptoms of extended or protracted or post-acute withdrawal will take 6 to 18 months to resolve themselves. If this is really severe, these people are going to be constitutionally incapable of working a program of rigorous honesty. Their brain is going to be dysfunctional. They will be in what is often called a neurotoxic fog. They can't think clearly. They can't remember things. Their emotions are erratic. They're either overreacting or emotionally numbed off. They can't sleep. They're exaggerating every stressor in their life. And these people can definitely benefit from help over and above AA, because AA does not teach about post-acute withdrawal, nor does it teach about managing it, although many of the principles involved in AA are very effective. So what do we have? If someone's physically sick, get them into medical treatment, along with AA. If they're in acute withdrawal, get the person into detoxification services with AA. If they have post-acute withdrawal, get them into treatment with a specialist who knows how to teach them how to manage these symptoms along with AA. In another category, called personality or mental disorders. There are many recovering people who have personality disorders and mental disorders. Now, I want to state very clearly that personality problems or mental disorders do not cause alcoholism or other addictions. And I want to re-emphasize this because it's so important. The presence of personality disorders, the presence of other mental disorders such as depression or anxiety disorders, does not cause addiction. But it sure does complicate recovery from it. Members of AA, one member of AA once told me, he says, Terry, it's the same thing that I observed in this fellowship. It seems like if you take a drunken son of a bitch and you get him sober, you have a sober son of a bitch. Now what we're looking at here is we're looking at a person, if you have a pre-existing personality disorder, you start drinking and the alcohol and drug use help to manage that personality disorder. When you get sober, as your brain returns to normal, your pre-existing personality structure comes back. It comes back. So people are going to need psychotherapy. Now I want to make one other point. First of all, personality disorders, mental disorders do not cause addiction, number one. Number two, among recovering alcoholics, the recovering alcoholics are no more or no less mentally ill than the rest of the population. Now, I want to repeat this because this is a true statement, statistically verifiable. Recovering alcoholics are no more or no less mentally ill than the rest of the population. That is a true statement. It is not a compliment. The level of mental and emotional disturbance among the general adult population is about 30%. One-third of the adult population suffers from serious personality disorders or some other major mental disorder that is serious enough to cause them to consider getting therapy for it. They suffer from serious enough mental and emotional disturbances that those disturbances interfere with their ability to live effectively. If you translate this to alcoholics, one-third of all alcoholics are going to have serious mental and emotional problems. In the fellowship of AA, these are called character defects. And if they're serious enough, they interfere with a person's ability to stay sober, and they need treatment. AA helps people stay sober. It doesn't help people recover from personality disorders, major depressions, phobias, anxiety disorders, and right on down the list of other major mental disorders. The final thing that AA doesn't help with is severely disrupted social environments, especially in young people such as adolescents. Many times, in addition to AA, people are going to need halfway houses, quarterway houses, extended living environment, because their social life is just so totally disrupted. They don't have a steady domicile. Their family of origin is so dysfunctional that they can't safely return there. There are numerous actively using alcoholics and addicts in the family of origin. Okay? So let's just go through the list of what you should look for. Okay? AA is going to require additional therapy. There's going to have to be something in addition to AA if there's coexisting physical illness, number one. Number two, if a person requires detoxification, if they are sick with the immediate after effects of alcoholism. Number three, if the person has severe post-acute withdrawal, if they're in a neurotoxic fog. Number four, if the person has serious personality or mental disorders that coexist with the addiction. And number five, if the person has a severely disrupted social life. Because if a person has any of those five coexisting conditions, and you as a professional therapist refer only to AA, there's a high chance that AA won't work. And why not? Well, you know, pencil sharpeners are wonderful inventions. They do a great job sharpening pencils. But did you ever try to sharpen a kitchen knife with a pencil sharpener? It doesn't work very well. AA is a wonderful pencil sharpener, and the pencil it is designed to sharpen is the disease of alcoholism, the disease of chemical dependency. It doesn't work real well on other problems. That's why the program has to be adapted, and that's why, okay, my recommendation to every recovering person I have ever met is that they pursue their recovery with a combination of resources. AA being the foundation of recovery, and then using other forms of medical, psychological, and social therapy as needed in the recovery process. I call this approach the 12-step plus approach. The unequivocal, most important, most effective way to get recovery is to combine the 12-step program with other forms of physical, psychological, and social therapies as required. And this in no way contradicts the 12-step program or the AA program. Now, what is AA? Let's get right down to the basics. First of all, if I can just find out who I'm talking to. How many people here are recovering from alcoholism? How many people here are recovering from chemical dependencies other than alcoholism? How many are chemically dependent when you combine alcohol and other drugs, just so I can see? How many here are involved in Al-Anon? How many are involved with ACOA? Come from dysfunctional families. How many have not raised their hands in any way, shape, or form so far? So you're not chemically addicted, right? You're come from a functional family. Your parents were not alcoholic, chemically dependent. Okay? You're not married to an actively using or drinking alcoholic. You're welcome anyway. At some of these conferences, people who are not affected by the disease are the minority group. And what we're going to do is we're going to talk about AA, and we're going to try and be as open as we possibly can here. And it's very important to understand where you come from. And I'll guarantee you something. I counted about 50 or 60 people who raised their hands and said, I am none of the above. I guarantee that at least 20% of you will change your mind by 5 o'clock tomorrow. And I want you to be open to being surprised. And here's why I say this. 10% of the adult population is suffering from some form of chemical dependency. This has been true historically. Every chemically dependent person affects, on the average, of 3 children. 3 children. Which means 30% of the population are ACOA, adult children of alcoholics, adversely affected by parental alcoholism. It also is a disease of denial, and people don't recognize it. And every alcoholic mostly gets married to somebody, which means 10% of the population are ready for Al-Anon, whether they know it or not. That also is a disease of denial, and an untreated codependent, when I say, do you fit any of these groups? No, I don't. Not me. I need to look good at all costs. So I don't know which of you will, but some of you may find your life get saved in the next 2 days. And I think it's absolutely amazing how many training programs for counselors and therapists and so on that I run, and I find that between 10 and 20% of the non-addicted participants discover they are. And about 30% of the helpers discover they have been affected by somebody else's chemical dependency. Now, what is Alcoholics Anonymous? AA is a worldwide fellowship of men and women who help each other to maintain sobriety by freely sharing their experiences with alcohol and drug use. Okay? It's a voluntary fellowship. No one is forced to go. I have a personal opinion here. No treatment center should force patients to involuntarily attend community-based AA meetings. Why? It violates the traditions of AA, which we will talk about later in this presentation. AA is a voluntary organization. I knew a meeting in San Diego, California, operating about 16 years ago. It was a nice meeting, 10 or 12 local people. They then opened up the Naval Rehab, where all of the young sailors with chemical abuse problems were sentenced to go to AA. And on Friday night, a truck pulls up outside of this community-based 12-person AA meeting and unloads 67 involuntarily referred naval candidates in uniform who walk into the meeting with a chip card that has to be signed by the speaker. Now, members of AA ain't no fools. The 12 AA members closed up shop and moved their meeting. Because why? It destroyed that meeting. It destroyed that meeting. If you are a professional doing therapy with chemically dependent people, you need to understand the fellowship of AA and how to work with it. And what I just described is not how to do it. I was very angry a year and a half ago at a national cocaine conference where four experts, national experts on cocaine abuse, stood up and publicly indicted AA for not openly allowing cocaine addicts to come to their meeting and demanded that AA change its policy. And ladies and gentlemen, I was professionally embarrassed because that showed the ignorance of those cocaine treatment experts on the role of AA and the role of 12-step programs and how they operate. And as professionals, and right now I'm speaking to you as a professional, we don't meddle in AA, period. We cooperate, we don't affiliate, and we do not tell AA how to do its job. And the reason is very clear. If AA were to start listening to us professionals, we would screw it up. And I want to be very clear about that, because if you're not familiar with AA, AA will do a tremendous job for you if you cooperate with it and leave it alone. You start messing with it, and it'll backlash on you in a minute, because AA is and will forever remain unprofessional. It is and will forever remain voluntary. And as professionals, we can reap the benefits of it if we refer patients and cooperate, but not try to affiliate or control. Now, AA is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other in an effort to recover. Father Martin had the opportunity to talk with Bill Wilson when he was alive. And very interesting, Bill's story. He tried to stay sober all by himself for a long period of time, and he could never put together more than a few weeks of sobriety. Then he got this crazy notion that maybe he could help himself by helping other people to stay sober. So he went out, and the first approach he tried was what I call the scrape them off the bar stool approach. He started taking all of his friends he knew who had drinking problems and tried to talk them into getting sober. And he went out on a crusade to try and get drunk sober. 6 months later, he sat down with his wife and he says, "Dear, I have failed. I've been trying to help alcoholics now for 6 months and I haven't helped one person to get sober." And his wife looked at him and says, "Bill, you're wrong. You haven't had a drink in 6 months." And hence, one of the first principles of AA was born. And that is summarized in a slogan that says, "In order to keep it, you have to give it away." And the benefit of AA is that 12-step members, recovering people in 12-step programs, get well by helping others to get well. As a counselor, this is very understandable to me, because what we begin to see is the principle of interrupting addictive self-centeredness. The addict no longer remains the central part of their own personal network. They have to expand their world beyond the tip of their nose. There's an old joke. Do you know how many grandiose alcoholics it takes to screw in a light bulb? Only one. They hold it up to the socket, and it screws itself in as the world revolves around them. Now, do you know how many Al-Anons it takes to screw in a light bulb? It doesn't take any. They just detach and let it screw itself. Now, I'm going to be speaking to you in the course of this workshop on two very different levels. I'm talking to you right now as a professional, based on 17 years of counseling experience, supervisory experience, administrative experience, research experience, experience as a workshop leader. I've been around in this field for over 17 years. I worked my way up from the role of counselor tech on a psych unit that treated alcoholics, and I've done just about every job there is to do in the field of chemical dependency. So professionally, I know of what I speak. I have made just about every mistake as a professional there is to be made in coordinating with Alcoholics Anonymous, but fortunately, I've learned from my mistakes, and I have had some of the best successes in treatment programs I've run in terms of responsibly and effectively networking with the AA people in the community. So that's one level. I'm going to talk to you as Terry Gorski, the professional. There's another level that I'm going to talk with you at also. I'm going to talk with you as Terry G., a recovering chemically dependent person, recovering from alcoholism. Because doing a workshop like this, I want to set a climate. And that climate I want to set is an openness and a willingness to share. But I want you to not confuse the two different hats. How many of you people wear two hats? Your professional hat and your recovering hat. Either as a recovering chemically dependent person, a person recovering in Al-Anon, a person recovering in the ACOA movement. And we have to be very careful which hat we put on and which hat we wear. Because as I'm talking, there is no way I can talk about the AA program in any way at all without projecting Terry G., the recovering person, onto what I say. I'm going to try and be as objective as I can and talk to you as Terry Gorski, the professional, but any of you who have been around the program realizes when you start dealing with program, your real self comes out. And you're going to see that, which is why there is this disclaimer. What I'm going to tell you about AA is going to be filtered through my own personal interpretations of the program. And my interpretations are not necessarily better than anybody else's. And we'll talk about this. One of the powers of AA is its ambiguity. Because the ambiguity of the AA program forces people to put their own meaning onto the program. And it forces people to make up their mind and decide what those principles mean for them. And one of the hallmarks of AA is that it's a selfish program. We decide for ourselves what we take out of those meetings, and nobody tells us what our experience is. We take what fits, and we leave the rest. And that's a hallmark that is shared at many of the meetings. Now, AA works in a variety of different levels, and there are four major structures of AA that make it work. As a professional, you need to understand this. Structure number one is meeting. And we are going to not only talk about what AA meetings are like here, we are going to experience what AA meetings are like here. We are going to have many meetings, four of them today at least, four of them tomorrow at least, and I'm going to expect each of you to participate. Of course, as with any AA meeting, the minimum level of participation is to say, I pass. You're not obligated to say any more than that when your turn comes to talk. You don't want to share anything, just say, I pass, and no one's going to hassle you. Okay? The second level of the program is sponsorship. You not only go to a meeting, you hook up with someone who's got more experience and more knowledge of the 12-step program than you do. In the business world, a sponsor is called a mentor. Someone who knows more than you do about the program and can show you the ropes. The third level, level one, AA calls it bringing the body to meetings. At the first level of AA, you do what AA calls 90 and 90. You make 90 meetings in 90 days. You bring the body into a meeting where you have exposure with other recovering people. One person once said to his sponsor, "But I don't like to go to meetings." And the sponsor says, "You don't have to like it. You just gotta do it." There's good news and there's bad news. The bad news is meetings aren't always fun. The good news is you don't have to like it. You just gotta go. Okay? Then the second level is you find a sponsor. You hunt out somebody who has personal characteristics you would like to emulate. Does this make sense? You find someone who's living the kind of life you'd like to have. Someone who's got the kind of characteristics you'd like to develop. And you walk up to them and say, "Could we establish a relationship where you teach me how you got what you got? Would you share that with me?" And that's called a sponsor. And there's a slogan in the 12-step program which says, "If you want what we got, you do what we did." And it is in the sponsorship relationship that this principle comes alive. And one of the frightening things that I see happening across the country as I talk to AA members is that sponsorship is breaking down. And it's something that really needs to be strengthened and reinforced. A therapist does not take the place of a sponsor. And so when you're working with your patients in your professional role, number one, encourage them to go to meetings. I don't mandate it, but sometimes I say, "Hey, if you're not willing to go to AA, I'm not willing to treat you." Why? Because if you're not willing to go and find out what it's all about, I don't think you really want to get sober. So what I do is I ask people to treat their initial AA involvement like a college course. I want them to go to meetings for one quarter, 12 meetings, 3 months. And I want them to view it like a college course. And I don't care if you like each individual class or not, I want you to graduate from the course. And then at the end of that 90-day period, we will be visiting together, working on your issues related to your addiction. You will be going to 12-step meetings, and then at the end of 3 months, I will ask you what your decision is about whether you believe that AA can help you or not. But until you have 3 months exposure on a minimum basis of 2 to 3 meetings a week, you don't know enough about AA to make a rational, informed judgment. And if you think you do, that's your addictive craziness attacking you. That's your addictive thought disorder. You can't make a judgment about something without knowing what it is. And during that 3 months, I want people to read the big book and to read the 12 and 12. The 12 steps and 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we got meetings. Second is sponsorship. I want you to get a temporary sponsor. And I get real pushy here. In every treatment center I've ever run, as a treatment center, we find past graduates who are doing well in their recovery, who are active in AA, and we create a list of temporary sponsors. People who are willing, as people get through our treatment center, to take the newcomers out into the AA community and show them the ropes. Not forever, but for a short period of time, long enough for them to get oriented in and find another sponsor. And we have these people come into our facility as 12-step volunteers and interact with patients, but we want to assure that their first sponsor understands treatment and understands the 12-step program to help the person form a bridge between the two so that the person's not put in the position of having to choose treatment or AA. Meeting sponsorship. The third level is step work. We are going to spend the bulk of this 2 days looking at the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and talking about what they mean. I'm going to share with you my personal interpretation of what they mean. I'm going to share with you my professional understanding of how the steps interact with psychotherapy. And I'm going to put you into groups and let you struggle with what they really mean for you. I'm not right and I'm not wrong. I got an opinion. And opinions are a lot like belly buttons. Everyone's got one and most of them look different. So I'm not trying to push my opinions onto you. I'm simply going to do in this workshop what is done in AA meetings over what is it, over 33,000 regularly scheduled AA meetings operating in 92 different countries. So I'm going to do what is done 33,000 times a week worldwide, and I'm going to share with you, to the best of my ability, my perception of the truth about recovery using the AA principles. Then you're going to have an opportunity to see how that fits with you, so you can take what fits and you can leave the rest. And you may leave here tomorrow saying, nothing fits my professional or personal experience. You may decide to leave the whole workshop behind. I doubt it, but that's a possibility, and that's okay with me. I don't need for you to believe anything that I believe. Because you see, in AA, AA is a program of attraction, not promotion. Very important. If you're in a treatment center and you're doing media advertising, never, absolutely never use the name of AA in your promotional work. Why? Violates the tradition. AA without $1 of media advertising has millions of members worldwide. And it's even flourishing in the Soviet Union. How come? Attraction, not promotion. And I think that AA is going to get screwed up in the Soviet Union. Why? The government's getting involved. Don't screw anything up, get the government involved. Think of AA managed like the post office. Can you imagine it? Okay? So you've got meetings, you've got sponsorship, you've got step work, and the fourth area of AA that needs to be attended to is the traditions. Every organization has to have bylaws, and AA is no exception. There are 12 fundamental bylaws that govern the operations of AA, and that is called the traditions. That is called the traditions. And we're simply going to briefly review the traditions. We're not going to go into depth about them. Now, as I mentioned, there are currently 33,000 local groups, AA groups, operating in 92 countries that are responsible for helping several hundred thousands of alcoholics to maintain recovery. And this is not talking about Narcotics Anonymous, Marijuana Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Paris Anonymous, Emotions Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, and I could go on to name 33 anonymous type organizations. As a matter of fact, it should be a new organization called Anonymous Anonymous. For those of us who get hopelessly addicted to self-help groups. So you see, you've got to get your sense of humor working a little better than this, folks, you know. Laugh, it makes me feel very good. Okay? Now, AA is solely involved in supporting the personal recovery of its members. Period. That's its primary purpose. They are not in business to make money. They are not in business to do anything except help the personal recovery of its members. AA does not engage in research. It's not a research organization. So if you're a professional, you say, where's your research evidence? There isn't much. There's a couple of sociologists, a sociologist named Milton Maxwell, who tried to study AA. AA does a world survey of its members every couple of years, and they publish that through their New York office, but it's not scientifically valid. How do you research an organization that has no membership list? How do you research an organization where all their meetings are not even listed? You want to have a meeting? You get two people together with a big book, you got a meeting. How do you research a group like that? So then we're not in the business to research, we're in the business to help people to recover. They are not medical or psychiatric treatment oriented. There are no professionals involved in AA. They don't do medical treatment, they don't do psychiatric treatment, they don't do psychotherapy. And I'll tell you, if you're involved in any 12-step program and you have a psychotherapist in charge of your group who runs it like a therapy group, get out of that group and run as fast as you can in the opposite direction. Rarely, if ever, happens in AA, but there's a new 12-step program where this type of abuse is occurring widespread, and it's called ACOA. If an ACOA meeting is run by a psychotherapist who does psychotherapy with the members, it's not ACOA, it's a therapy group. And learn the difference. Because proper ACOA is based on the 12 steps of AA, and the leaders act in a non-professional role. AA is not involved in politics. Although we're not endorsing candidates, we're not doing any of this. And AA does not endorse or support any causes. That's why it survived for so long. It does one thing. If you want to get sober, you want to get straight and sober, go to AA and you get help. Period. as a member, you help others, period. You're not going to be hit on for donation support to get involved in anything else. As a member, however, as individual AA members, we have a right to be involved in anything else we want. We can be involved in any religion, any political form, any cause, anything we want. We are free to do anything. There's no restrictions. Nobody's forced to do anything. One of the few organizations I know of in America today that supports our inherent constitutional right to do what we want. It's a free organization. There's no coercion. Which is why I strongly believe treatment centers should not coerce people to go to AA. They should negotiate initial exposure, but you don't force people to do it. It ruins the climate and the environment of AA meetings. Okay? Now, AA has a policy of cooperation, not affiliation. If you call AA and say, how do I get a franchise? You don't. If you're a treatment center and you say, I'd like a meeting in my facility, what do I do? They'll tell you, sign a room, we'll send some people out to start one. But then if you say, well, I want one of my staff members to run it, AA will say, I'm sorry, we don't do that. AA runs itself. Okay? Cooperation, not affiliation. AA is self-supporting through its own members' contributions. It declines any contributions from outside sources. NIAAA wanted to fund AA when it first got established by Congress, because that's how the government controls people, if you're not aware of this. They give you money, and then you get dependent on the money, and they say, live my way or we take it away. Control. And AA members are smart enough to realize if you don't pay your own way, you're controlled by somebody else, and AA pays its own way. How do they do it? Collection basket is passed around at every meeting. People typically throw in a buck per meeting. Any psychotherapist here? Isn't that scary? Can you imagine running a therapy group and saying, hey, here's a contribution plate, put in what you think this group was worth? Oh, that's kind of terrifying. That's how AA supports itself. That's how they do it. And most groups voluntarily take a percentage of the pot that they collect and send it to the New York office and the regional offices, where they maintain phone numbers so that people who call looking for AA, they're listing in the phone book. You want to find AA? Go to any reasonably well-sized community, look in the phone book under Alcoholics Anonymous. You'll find a number, you call, there'll be somebody there who answers the phone, or there'll be an answering machine. You'll get a call back in most cases. Right. Now, members are encouraged to preserve their anonymity at the level of the press, films, and broadcast media. Okay? Why? Because the underlying principle in AA is to put principles before personality. What happens if somebody stands up and says, I am a reflection of AA, and then they do what many drunks do? They get drunk again. Okay? Now, we've had widespread violation of anonymity, and there's a big controversy about that within the program, whether it's good or bad. Many public figures have stood up and said, I'm a recovering alcoholic at the level of press and media. Certain treatment centers that treat celebrities, I think one of the conditions of being admitted is that they have a press conference on the second day in detox to announce that they're there. These are very questionable practices, because what it does is it makes the personality more important than the disease, and it makes the personality more important than the recovery process, and it diminishes the importance of the fundamental principle. It doesn't make any difference whether an individual member gets drunk or stays sober. The important thing is there are principles there that can work in people's lives. And this is what has to be acknowledged at the level of press and media. So members are encouraged not to do big news releases and so on. Now, it is widely recognized that the most effective treatment program will cooperate and strongly encourage all patients to attend AA meetings. As a matter of fact, if you don't, forget getting referrals from 90% of all industrial referral sources. I had a friend, he's now dead, his name was Tom Reed. Tom was a long-term member of AA, and he was a marketing specialist for Chemical Dependency Program. And when he went in to talk to hospital administrators, he called AA the Muscatel Mafia. You know, it's a kind of quiet underground organization. But you mess with AA, and you're messing with one whole hell of a lot of people. Okay? And I'll tell you, in the addiction treatment field, I don't know very many aspects of the addiction treatment field that are not heavily influenced by recovering people. You scratch any treatment program hard enough, you find 40 to 50% of the people are sober through the fellowship, very protective of the fellowship. And they're going to be looking toward how programs approach their relationship with the 12-step fellowship. And if you don't get along with AA, you're not going to be very well received into the global community of the addiction treatment industry. And this is a very important thing to recognize. AA, as an organization, doesn't do anything, but there's a very powerful network of individual members. And boy, I have learned about it. I went to California 1 year and got sick and ended up in an intensive care unit. I called my program coordinator who was running my program in my absence, and before I said anything, he said, "I hear you're in the hospital." San Diego to Chicago, and they knew it before I could pick up a phone and call. I was very sick for 2 days, and I couldn't call. It took 2 days for the grapevine to get the news back to my treatment center, independent of the treatment of a call. What hospital I was in, where I was at. Okay? It was called the grapevine. And AA has a publication called the AA Grapevine. And the grapevine is very real. The grapevine is very real. And you need to recognize the power of the grapevine, because that's the network. That's the substance of the community we're talking with. And it's a powerful community. Very powerful. And it helps people to stay sober, and that's what it does.